Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
You ever stumbled across an argument between a couple, maybe overheard the couple? Kind of awkward in those moments in a nearby restaurant booth. And instantly thought, wow, that sounds exactly like someone I know. Well, that's the feeling that settled across the courtroom on April 24th of 2025 when jurors in Karen Reed's retrial for the death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe got an unfiltered glimpse into the tense dynamics of the couple's private life. This is the day three recap of the trial of Karen Reed. We're going to break down all the testimony for you today, who said what it all means, and love to see your reactions in the comment section on YouTube. If you're listening to us on a podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, wherever it may be sure to check us out on YouTube where you can interact and comment on the cases as well. Press subscribe wherever you're at right now so you don't miss any of our coverage on these cases. We got tons of it for you. It wasn't explosive physical evidence or shocking eyewitness testimony that held the room captive day three of the trial of Karen Reed. It was something subtler in a way far more uncomfortable read. Karen and John's own words laid bare for everyone to hear. Trooper Nicholas Guerrero, a Massachusetts State Police investigator specializing in digital forensic, took the stand to introduce and read out aloud previously unseen text messages extracted from their phones, messages sent just hours before John's tragic death in January of 2022. You see, in the calm, measured voice you'd expect from someone whose job mostly involves sifting through digital footprints, Rana began narrating a conversation that very well could have been lifted straight from the textbook of emotional manipulation, something you'd probably recognize if you've ever had to navigate a relationship with someone whose feelings often eclipse everyone else's. It started innocently enough. Karen sending John a pointed question. Tell me if you're interested in someone else. I can't think of any other reason you'd been like this. Notice an ongoing theme of jealousy here with Karen. Simple jealousy, perhaps, or insecurity. But listen closer, and there's something more calculated beneath the surface. By framing it this way, Karen positioned John defensively. The implication, clear. His recent emotional distance wasn't merely his problem. It was a personal betrayal, an accusation requiring immediate reassurance or apology. John's reply was short, a blunt, nope, denying any romantic wandering. But then he tried to push the conversation towards something broader and healthier, adding, things haven't been great between us for a while. Ever consider that? It was a straightforward attempt at honesty, a plea to step outside the drama and confront the bigger picture. But rather than take this moment to reflect or communicate openly, Karen pivoted immediately, pulling out the move from the narcissist playbook, redirecting the blame. And remember, Karen had already been asking one of John's friends to come over and sleep with her, or her go there. I forgot what the order was. Because they're both single. They're both adults. Never mind, you're with John O'Keefe, and now you're the one that's flirting with one of his friends, and you're all paranoid that John's doing that? Sorry. That's on you. That's you throwing all that out there and blaming somebody else for what you are feeling inside. The text became a carefully choreographed dance of deflection, accusation, and guilt-tripping. Karen's messages painted John as an irrational, emotionally volatile, somewhat impossible to please, claiming he regularly flew off the handle at 8 a.m. and implying he was deliberately sabotaging their relationship. Hmm. I mean, like you trying to invite his friend over, or you going to his friend's house to get it on? That's not trying to sabotage the relationship, Karen. Anyway, each line seemed designed to elicit sympathy for her. Surprise. To portray John as unpredictable and unfairly critical. It felt eerily familiar, like those moments when you're arguing with someone who always manages to shift responsibility, turning even their own mistakes into your fault. You know the drill. Criticize, deflect, then guilt. Rinse, repeat. Criticize, deflect, then guilt. Rinse, repeat. The tension peaked when John admitted he was sick of always arguing. It was a vulnerable moment, a sincere expression of exhaustion from months of emotional turmoil. But Karen's response showed no compassion, no acknowledgement of shared responsibility. Instead, she doubled down. Shifting the narrative again, she expressed hurt as his behavior, as if John's frustration was entirely unprovoked. The subtext was very clear. He was responsible for her feelings, her reactions, and her pain. Every exchange subtly but unmistakably reinforced a pattern, one where John was consistently expected to carry the emotional burden while Karen positioned herself as the perpetual victim. And again, none of this makes her a murderer. We're just learning a lot about Karen Reed. And perhaps that's why the judge Beverly Cannoni's ruling earlier that day to allow Grano to read those messages aloud despite defense's objections felt especially significant. The defense team argued that allowing a state trooper to voice these texts directly might influence jurors unfairly, perhaps dramatizing or skewing perception, but Cannoni didn't buy it. She wanted jurors to hear these words exactly as they were written, directly and without filters. The courtroom atmosphere was tense, each juror leaning slightly forward, absorbing the conversation's escalating toxicity. Friends and family in the gallery were visibly squirming. I mean, imagine sitting there, hearing your private relationship, the dysfunction, complete with manipulation and emotional chess moves, broadcast aloud in front of strangers. It was deeply personal, yet deeply revealing. Through these messages, jurors saw firsthand how Karen Reed allegedly engaged in a relationship dynamic, often characteristic of narcissistic control. The text didn't show violent anger or threats. Instead, they illustrated something quieter, yet subtly devastating. The insidious erosion of emotional boundaries. the subtle twisting of reality, where one partner's emotions dominate and the other's experiences and feelings become invisible. For anyone who's ever engaged in a similar relationship, these texts likely felt painfully familiar, even triggering. It's the emotional equivalent of gaslighting, a steady drip of guilt, blame, and emotional manipulation designed to keep someone exactly where they're wanted. It's the kind of thing that rarely gets exposed publicly, hidden behind closed doors and silenced by shame or embarrassment, or not even understanding what's going on. But today in this courtroom, nothing was hidden. The words Karen and John exchanged just hours before tragedy struck were displayed openly, making clear to the jury the emotional context leading up to John's untimely death. The prosecutors didn't have to dramatize or exaggerate. Karen's own words laid out the pattern plainly enough. And the final twist in these texts offered perhaps the sharpest insight of all. After a flurry of accusations and guilt trips, Karen suddenly pivoted, suggesting they meet up for drinks later that evening, as if nothing had happened. It's the ultimate emotional whiplash, typical of relationships driven by control rather than genuine connection. Familiar script, again, for anyone who's ever dealt with a partner who can switch emotional states on a dime, leaving you dazed, confused, and desperately grasping for stability. As he finished reading, a heavy silence fell across the courtroom. The jurors now had a clear, factual snapshot of the relationship dynamics that had simmered beneath the surface for months. They heard firsthand how Karen Reed's text illustrated a troubling pattern, one where emotional manipulation and subtle control tactics dominated interactions. It wasn't about dramatic accusations or obvious threats of violence. It was something deeper, more nuanced, something that jurors would need to carefully consider when deciding Karen's role in the tragedy that soon followed. These texts, more than just words on a screen, were the window into the very soul of this case. And as the judge announced a brief recess, you couldn't help but sense that the jurors had plenty to reflect on. Because soon, they'd be piecing these emotional puzzle pieces together with other evidence from that night, like surveillance footage and eyewitness accounts of John and Karen's behavior. But before those crucial pieces fell into place, jurors would first have to grapple with the quiet yet profound revelations they'd just heard. Delivered in Karen's own words, understandably or undeniably raw and utterly unfiltered. You know what it is these days? Nearly every moment of our lives is caught on camera. You walk into any store, bar, or restaurant, and you're instantly cast as an extra in the background of someone else's life. Most times these images are meaningless. They're snippets of ordinary days destined for deletion after a few weeks. But sometimes those grainy, silent clips, they become a crucial puzzle piece in stories we desperately need to understand. That's exactly what happened in the courtroom today, day three of the trial of Karen Reed for the death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe. After the morning's tense exploration of emotionally charged text messages, prosecutors turned to something more objective, security footage from two bars Karen and John visited during their last night together. The jurors leaned forward in anticipation, eager for clarity after navigating the messy emotional landscape they'd just been shown earlier. First to the stage was Gene DeMullis, general manager of C.F. McCarthy's Pub, a cozy spot known well by locals in Canton. Her role wasn't dramatic. She calmly confirmed that the video about to be played was authentic and taken directly from the bar's surveillance system. Defense attorneys had no objections. It was straightforward, routine courtroom procedure. Yet everyone in the gallery kind of felt a little quiet tension as the footage started up. The jurors watched silently as grainy black and white footage appeared, offering a bird's eye view from behind the bar. The silent video showed Karen Reed and John O'Keefe clearly. It wasn't a dramatic or explosive scene. Instead, it was portrayed as something simple. Two people out for drinks, sitting near each other, chatting easily. Karen occasionally touched John's arm, leaned in close as if sharing a private joke. John seemed relaxed, comfortable. There were no exaggerated gestures, no visible arguing, and no apparent signs of tension. If you'd stumbled upon the video randomly, you might assume it was nothing more than a happy couple enjoying a casual night out. And that's exactly how their friend, Michael Caminero, described it when he took the stand. Unlike DeMullis, Camerano wasn't just verifying footage. He was there, a real eyewitness who spent hours with Karen and John that evening. Michael's voice carried an air of sincerity as he recounted arriving at C.F. McCarthy's with John to celebrate their children being accepted to the same high school, a normal, joyful reason to be out together. He described Karen joining them later, warmly greeting John. Michael emphasized he saw nothing tense or troubling. John and Karen appeared happy, even affectionate. It was just friends sharing drinks, laughter, and everyday conversation. Listening to Michael speak, you couldn't help but picture a typical Friday night. Friends gathered around a bar, casual jokes bouncing back and forth, small moments of shared affection between couples. Michael's memories match the security footage perfectly. No signs of conflict, no raised voices, nothing unusual. Then prosecutors shifted attention to the second location, Waterfall Bar and Grill, another Canton establishment where Karen and John continued their evening. Like before, manager Bridget Meehan testified briefly and clearly, authenticating her own bar's security footage. The courtroom again grew quiet as jurors focused on the second video, hoping perhaps this footage might provide deeper insights into what was happening between the couple. But once again, jurors saw only calm normalcy. The footage showed Karen and John comfortably interacting, smiling, chatting, and appearing entirely ordinary. John appeared relaxed and engaged, Karen similarly comfortable, frequently leaning close to John, her hand gently resting on his shoulder at one point. The couple blended seamlessly into the casual atmosphere around them, their behavior indistinguishable from any other pair of friends or romantic partners spending a pleasant evening together. As the footage concluded, you could feel an unspoken question hanging heavily in the courtroom. How could such normal moments turn so tragic just hours later? Prosecutors presented these clips without fanfare, no attempts to interpret or dramatize. It was simply evidence objectively presented, and jurors were left to weigh the striking contrast themselves. The earlier text messages suggested friction and emotional strain, yet the videos depicted nothing but calm, easy interactions. It was a puzzle piece that didn't fit neatly into any simple narrative. Michael returned to his testimony briefly, concluding his recollection by describing how he'd said goodnight, leaving Karen and John still happily seated at the bar. At the time, nothing about the couple's demeanor had set off any alarms or concerns. Michael's testimony, combined with the bar footage, underscored the simplicity and the perplexity of the situation. He had no way of knowing that when he had said goodbye, he was witnessing the final calm moments between two people whose lives were about to change irreversibly. For the jurors, this evidence posed complex questions. How could two people move so swiftly from a calm night of friendly companionship to a tragedy no one saw coming? The video footage was clear and undeniable. No theatrics, no evident hostility. Instead, jurors saw only ordinary, peaceful moments. A powerful contradiction to the tension-laden text messages presented earlier. The courtroom sat quietly, absorbing what they'd just seen. There was a palpable sense that jurors now faced an even tougher task. They had to reconcile two completely different types of evidence, emotional text exchanges filled with strain and accusation against calm, objective footage that portrayed nothing unusual. As the prosecution closed their presentation of the bar videos, the jurors understood their challenge was becoming clearer but simpler. They would soon be asked to weigh those two seemingly contradictory pictures against the stark reality of what had occurred just hours later. But before that step, there was another vital element to consider. The critical events immediately after Karen Reed found John O'Keefe outside, motionless in the snow. It's strange how clearly certain moments stick in your mind, how the details feel etched in stone. Ask any first responder, and they'll tell you some scenes never really fade, no matter how many months or even years go by. For Daniel Whitley, a Canton firefighter, a paramedic, the morning he encountered Karen Reed and John O'Keefe was one of those moments, one that was vividly brought back to life in the courtroom on day three of the trial of Karen Reed. Whitley sat on the stand, his voice steady, measured, as he walked the jury through the early hours of January 29th, 2022. He described receiving the urgent call to respond to 34 Fairview Road in Canton, not quite sure exactly what he'd find, but knowing someone was in desperate trouble. It was dark, it was cold, and it was still snowy, a typical brutal New England winter morning. When Whitley arrived at the scene, he immediately saw Karen Reed. She was frantic, visibly distressed, pacing near the snow-covered driveway. Before he could even get a handle on the situation, Karen was already speaking rapidly, urgently questioning him. Whitley recalled how she repeated one question over and over again. Is there any chance he could still be alive? Even sitting outside in the snow for hours. Jurors listened intently, picturing the dark morning, feeling the urgency in Karen's voice through Whitley's testimony. Whitley himself seemed firmly convinced of his recollection. He described Karen as deeply distraught, almost desperately seeking reassurance, but simultaneously realistic about the harsh circumstances. He explained that after assessing John O'Keefe, who was lying motionless in the snow, the situation quickly shifted from rescue to tragedy. John was unresponsive, clearly beyond any medical help that could be offered at the scene. Whitley also recalled Karen expressing suicidal thoughts, a troubling admission that required immediate attention and action. The courtroom fell silent at that moment, jurors absorbing the depth of Karen's emotional state. He explained that due to her concerning statements, he transported Karen directly to Good Samaritan Medical Center for evaluation, ensuring her immediate safety. The picture Whitley painted was clear, factual, and deeply emotional, but the calm recounting the events didn't remain unchallenged for long. Defense attorney David Yannetti rose, carrying with him a stack of notes, his demeanor signaling that the jury was about to see an intense cross-examination. You know, of the first responder that's, I guess, in on this. Yannetti began methodically questioning Whitley about the specifics of his recollection from that morning, nearly 3 years prior. He quickly zeroed in on specific phrases Whitley had used, particularly Karen's repeated question about John's potential survival, despite hours outside in the freezing snow. Mr. Whitley, Yannetti asked carefully, isn't it true that your current testimony today includes details you did not previously mention in your initial grand jury statements? Whitley, calm and collected, admitted his earlier testimony might not have been as detailed, but firmly insisted he had not invented or exaggerated things. Yannetti pressed harder, highlighting specific discrepancies in Whitley's previous statements, emphasizing the absence of certain phrases or emotional descriptions that had appeared today. The back and forth grew tense, voices sharpening tightly. Jurors watched carefully, clearly assessing both Whitley's credibility and Yannetti's aggressive yet measured approach. At one point, Yannetti pointedly asked Whitley, are you certain your memory from 3 years ago is as accurate as you claim? Could you have unintentionally embellished these memories over time? Whitley responded firmly, without hesitation, assuring the courtroom his recollection was clear and truthful. The exchange was sharp, controlled, and purposeful, with jurors leaving a palpable sense of just how critical these tiny details might become in the final verdict. After Whitley left the stand, the prosecution shifted gears, introducing something that had previously sparked heated pretrial debate: the recorded interview Karen Reed gave publicly on national television, or at least parts of it. It was one of those interviews you might casually watch on a Friday night, tucked into your couch, half distracted. But now, here in court, it took a different weight entirely. As the video began to play, the courtroom quietly listened. On screen, Karen sat composed yet emotional, recounting those early moments after discovering John's body. Jurors watched closely, studying her expressions, her body language, then heard Karen vividly recount the reaction of John's mother, Peggy, upon seeing her son's body.
"He looks like he got hit by a car,"
is pretty much how she said it in that video. Extremely disrespectful to the mother of the woman, of the guy who you may have just hit and killed. This is more than just a dramatic statement. It was Karen herself publicly relaying words that now carried immense significance within the trial. Hearing Karen's own voice in her own words described that morning brought another layer of intensity to the jury's understanding of those critical early hours. Peggy's spontaneous remark now reverberated loudly in the courtroom as jurors silently absorbed its meaning. It wasn't a definitive conclusion, but it was a statement that hung in the air, capturing the shock and confusion of those tragic moments. Before the interview had actually even reached jurors' ears, it had been fiercely contested by the defense behind the scenes. Defense attorneys had vehemently objected to its admissibility. They argued that Karen's public statements, taken from a dramatic television interview rather than a formal interrogation, might unfairly influence jurors. After all, they contended, interviews designed for television are for drama or emotional appeal. They could distort perceptions, unintentionally adding or subtracting context. But Judge Beverly Cannone, after careful weighing of these concerns, had ultimately ruled against the defense, allowing jurors to hear Karen's recorded statements directly. Cannone's ruling wasn't an afterthought. It came from meticulous consideration, balancing the emotional power of Karen's recorded words with the jury's right to hear critical evidence. Her decision ensured jurors would not judge Karen's statements for themselves without additional interpretation. As the video concluded, the silence in the courtroom was striking, almost as if everyone present needed an extra second to fully grasp the weight of what they had just witnessed. It was now clear to the jurors that the first hours after John O'Keefe was found had been chaotic, emotional, and filled with crucial interactions that would be intensely scrutinized. Daniel Whitley's testimony offered a factual foundation. The trained observations of a professional who had been there managing the crisis. Karen's recorded interview provided an emotional and direct glimpse into her immediate thoughts and reactions, capturing the confusion and shock of those early moments. Together, these elements didn't offer easy answers. Instead, they underscored just how complicated and human this tragedy really was. Jurors faced a delicate balance, forced to consider both the emotional truth in Karen's own recorded words and the reliability of Whitley's detailed memories from years past. As the courtroom moved towards recess, jurors undoubtedly felt the heavy responsibility of the information they now possessed. They had seen the raw chaos of the immediate aftermath through Whitley's eyes, watched Karen struggle with the traumatic reality on camera, and observed the careful, rigorous legal battles unfolding right before them. The morning's testimony hadn't resolved every question. If anything, it only deepened the complexity that they faced. Karen Reed's testimony about drinking also made a lovely appearance today in many different clips, many contradicting different clips. According to her, in one clip, she had a vodka tonic about every 40 minutes. In another clip, she had about five drinks, maybe. In another clip, she'd ordered four drinks and then got an extra shot to go in each one of them because it just wasn't strong enough. It was just soda water. It's what it tasted like. When you get deep enough into that problem, you can get a pretty high tolerance. And it can kind of taste like soda water at a certain point. You got to add that extra shot in there, Karen, to make it better, which she did. And then when they left, she put three shots into a drink and then took that one to go. And in another one, she had maybe four drinks, but she didn't drink all of them. It was just a little bit. All completely different interviews, all completely different recollections of what happened that night. And it wasn't in the heat of the moment either. These were sit-down interviews with ABC, with NBC, with, you know, anybody who would listen, basically. And every time, she didn't seem to have the sense to keep her story straight. So there was that as well. Your thoughts on day three? Nothing here that shows that she killed John O'Keefe. Just more evidence of character. But character's not on question here, although it will be. We're going to get Proctor into this soon. And if his character matters, so does Karen's. Tell me what you think in the comment section on YouTube. Press subscribe right now so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case or any of the cases that we follow for you, whether it's on the podcast or on YouTube. Hit that subscribe button right now. We do greatly appreciate it. There you go. Day three. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us. We will talk again very soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Hurry! These July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is
Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short.
Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.